If the police went on strike, of course, you can imagine that there were many other groups of workers also on strike. The police are never the first to go on strike. One of the biggest ones, I'm just going to talk of some of the biggest ones, in Scotland, in January 1919, there was the strike which was called the 40 hours strike. This was naturally, as its name suggests, the demand was, we want to work 40 hours every week. Before they worked much more, and there were two reasons. There were two reasons for this. First of all, that they wanted more spare time. Oh, before the First World War, the working week was 54 hours. They worked 54 hours, and so the demand was 40 hours. No, 54. Yeah, 54 before the war, and the demand was for 40 hours. Two reasons. First of all, because they wanted a bit of time to do something else. And secondly, because, remember, you have more than 1 million soldiers who are going to come back to Britain. Everybody imagined there would be a big problem with unemployment. All these soldiers coming back, how are they going to find a job? And there was a big problem with unemployment in the 1920s. It was extremely common to see in the streets ex-soldiers trying to make a little money by playing a musical instrument badly. Or they used to push around a pram with a gramophone in it. And if you give a penny, they will wind it up and give you some music to listen to, a very bad quality. And that was very, very common, so there was a problem. And so this was one of the reasons also for the 40 hours. It was the idea that we will share out the available work. So on the 27th of January, the meeting of strikers had 3,000 people, and the next day there were 60,000. There was fights with the police. The strikers attempted to stop the trams, the tramway, and there were fights with the police, which went on quite a while. The army occupied the streets of Glasgow for about a week, with tanks and machine guns, very tense situation. Interestingly enough, the government decided not to send any Scottish soldiers to occupy Glasgow, only English soldiers. Classic tactic, because they were rather worried that the Scottish soldiers, their brother was on the other side, really cousins and very big families as well. That's the Catholic side of Scotland. And finally, the result of this was that the army succeeded in breaking the strike, and there was an agreement, and the agreement was exactly in the middle, not 54 hours, not 40 hours, 47 hours. So it was a semi-defeat, semi-victory. Half a defeat, half a victory. Not 54 hours, but not 40 hours, 47 hours. Okay, that was the result of it. Just one example. I have some more, because almost at the same time, in January 1919, you had problems in the army. But first of all, a word about the general situation. In 1919, there were 35 million strike days. I'm so near to the holidays, I don't even have a pen to write on the board anymore. So 35 million strike days in 1919. Remember, you count strike by strike days. That is, for example, if 10 workers go on strike for 100 days, that's 1,000 strike days. Or if 1,000 workers go on strike for one day, that's 1,000 strike days. You count strike days. Now, strike day statistics are not simple, because strikes can be long, strikes can be short because they are won very quickly. Or strikes can be short because They are lost very quickly, so it doesn't tell you everything, but strike days are one important measure. In 1919, there are 35 million strike days, which is the highest of the 20th century. A long way, by a long way, the highest of the 20th century. It's the biggest. The meaning of these strikes is contested. Some historians say that Britain was closer to revolution in 1919 than at any moment. Others say, oh, no, there was no danger of revolution. So that's a debate. Yeah, that's a debate. It's not been absolutely sorted. Certainly some sections of the elite believed that a revolution was possible in Britain. That's for sure. In particular, one of the signs is not just the strikes, the army, the police, engineers, miners, railway men, transport workers. All of those went on strike, but the beginnings of it was with the army. Okay. Although like I say, most of the army, although they found of course the experience of the war terrible, and quite often they hated their immediate superior. Nevertheless, in general, they thought it was better if Britain won the war. They were in favour of the war. They were against their own superior, but in favour of the war. And so once the war finished, it's not very complicated. They just wanted to go home. On peu comprendre. Yeah? Okay. And unfortunately, this was not so easy. First of all, the government did not want to bring back a million soldiers all at once. Partly because of reasons of unemployment, and partly because in a situation where there are strikes and contests, you add a million unhappy soldiers with guns, or who know how to use guns, it's rather delicate. And so for the demobilization was much slower than the soldiers wanted. And secondly, the British government wanted soldiers to go to Russia to fight against the revolution. After the Russian Revolution, soldiers from 15 or 20 countries were sent to fight against the new government, including British ones. However, quite a number of British soldiers, when they were told, "You are now going to go to Russia to fight against the Russian government," simply refused, and so there was a mutiny, and this began in Folkestone à côté de Douvres. 2,000 soldiers refused to go back onto their ships to go to Russia, and there was a big protest march in the town. And over the next 2 weeks, there were nearly 50 mutinies. There were nearly 50 mutinies around in the different sections of the Brit. 50, yeah. So in 50 different towns, yeah. Some of them towns in France, some of them towns in Egypt, there were 50 different mutinies, and they all had the same demands. One, we want to go home, yeah, more quickly. Two, we don't want to go and fight in Russia. Now, of course, we don't want to go fight in Russia was for different reasons. For a lot of soldiers, it was simply, we don't want to go and fight anywhere, we've had enough. And for others, it was, no, Russia, the Russian Revolutionary Government is good, we don't want to fight against them. So it was a very complicated situation. In one place in Scotland, they refused to, not only did they refuse to board the ships, but they put on the ships, they took down the British flag and raised the red flag. You can imagine that the government was rather unhappy. Also, some of the soldiers were protesting against bad treatment by their officers. Now, really, the government was obliged to capitulate immediately. Because 50 mutinies at once, it was too much for them. The commander-in-chief, General Haig, said, "Oh well, we need to do what do you do traditionally for a mutiny? You execute the leaders. This is the normal thing to do." But the government realised that this was too dangerous, and so no soldier was punished. You know, no soldier was punished. So that shows how frightened the government was. No soldier was punished by that. And they got some concessions on their demands. Other examples, then the miners. The miners demanded a 30% wage increase. And what's more, in fact, the miners had three demands. They wanted a 30% wage increase. Yeah, you can see that this is very. They were very confident. Yeah, yeah. If you're not confident, you ask for a 5% wage increase. Yeah, yeah. If you're confident, you have to be pretty confident. Okay, you have to be pretty confident about 30% wage increase. Yes. But this was the end of the war. You see, the attitude was, we did what you wanted for all the war. We won the war, so we want to profit from it. That was the idea. Yeah. Now the miners had three demands. First of all, a 30% wage increase. Secondly, we don't want to work 8 hours every day. We only want to work 6 hours a day, especially the underground workers. And finally, the nationalisation of the industry. We want the industry to be nationalised, and we want the control of the industry to be in the hands jointly of employers and the miners, as a sort of a joint control. Now, remember also at this time, first of all, that there are 1 million miners. Miners today is a small group, but this time the miners is massive. Yeah, that there's no oil, there's no nuclear power, there's just coal. So coal is central. Question? The nationalisation, la nationalisation de l'industrie. Okay. À une époque où il n'y avait quasiment pas d'industrie nationalisée, plus tardif. Right. Okay. So, what did the government do? Well, they established a committee. Yeah, this is all. Yeah, it's normal. Yeah, they established a committee, and there was a big discussion among the miners, and finally the leaders of the miners accepted this committee. The committee established a report. 3 weeks later, the committee wrote a report, and they said, okay, well, we will give you a 20% increase, and we will reduce your working hours from 8 hours a day to seven hours a day. And so an intermediate proposal. But again, you can see that the miners were right to be confident, because the government has committed to say, okay, 20%, yeah, okay, so yeah, the situation was good. However, of course, and this is not surprising, the question of nationalisation was what's the word in English, postponed, c'est-à-dire reporté, on va voir dans 6 mois. So, A few months later, in June, this is June
1919.
Why did they not accept the nationalization? Well, at this time, well, first of all, because the private companies who run the mines were very, very hostile. These were big private companies, and they didn't want to be nationalized. If you can imagine that, Microsoft. Yeah, imagine the American government, the workers of Microsoft ask the American government to nationalize Microsoft. Microsoft will not be very happy. Yeah, yeah, these are big private concerns. That's the first thing. And secondly, I think at this time, this is very early in nationalization. Today, nationalization, there are a lot of nationalized things, not so many as 20 years ago. But at the time, really, nationalization was considered to be a Bolshevik idea. An absolutely communist idea, a very, very radical left-wing idea. Yes, and so that made people very frightened. So, of course, the coal will be nationalised after the Second World War, and the railways and steel and electricity, in a different economic situation, and also when it becomes clear that nationalisation in itself is not so, does not put capitalism in danger. In 1919, many private companies said, if you nationalize the mines, afterwards they will nationalize all the other companies, and this will be terrible. Yeah? Whereas in 1949, nobody imagined, well, that's not quite true, but the majority of people did not imagine that a nationalisation was the beginning of nationalising all of them. It was seen in a different way. So that's the kind of reason it was also symbolic. Yeah, nationalisation just after the Russian Revolution was, in a way, like saying the Russians are right, you know. That what is the problem? The problem is profits. That's what they were saying. Okay, there's a reason. So, in any case, it did not get nationalized at this point in 1919. Notice that one of the reasons for the demand for nationalization was also about safety. There were very, very large numbers of people dying in the mines. This was one of the reasons the miners' trade union was so strong, because it was really a form of self-defense. I have a friend who was brought up in Newcastle, and her parents used to tell her that when they had an accident in the mines and some of the miners were trapped underground, every mine in the region went on strike until the miners came out, because they found that this encouraged the bosses to find the money and the equipment to get the miners out. Yeah. So it's very, 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 very solid. The miners were the strong, in the 20th century, the strongest trade union in Britain by a long way. I was in Yorkshire in the 1980s in the mining villages, and a miner who I spoke to said, "Do you see that man over there? A long way away." I said, "No shop in the village will serve him." I said, "Well, why not?" He said, "Well, because he refused to go on strike in 1926. Yeah, that was the atmosphere. Yeah, it was a question of life or death for the miners. And often it was a question of life or death, because people died in the mines. But the idea of refusing to strike was, it's like, you know, really, it was really the case for miners, even the miners I met in the 80s. If you said, you know, this man is a murderer and this man refuses to strike, they say, "Oh, let's go and have a drink," you know. The murderer, the refusing strike was worse, definitely. It was absolutely very, very, very difficult to explain, really, but extremely strong, because when the union got stronger, the number of people dying in the mines got less. You know, it's not complicated. So of course that also means that very often the government absolutely was very, very determined to win against the miners, because the miners were the symbol of the strongest. Yeah, and we will see that here. So what happens next with the miners here? This is getting a little bit complicated. Yes, the railwaymen. This was the other elements of strikes in Britain in 1919. Again, remember, the railways much more important than today. The railways are still important today, as we know. But remember, at the time, there were some cars. Il n'y a pas vraiment de camions en 1919. Si, si, un peu. Le transport, c'est le chemin de fer. And so there was also very unhappy about wages and so on. However, the trade union leadership of the railway workers threatened a strike, and then at the last moment decided not to. So there was no strike there. And that was the case during the summer. Towards the end of the year, in September, you got things happening differently. The government decided to reduce wages in the railway industry. Yeah, you see, the situation was different. The situation in January, you'd have the police and the mutinies. The government came, "Oh yeah, okay, we agree. But in the autumn, the movement had gone down, and so the government felt much more confident. They announced wage cuts, and there was a huge strike, and the railwaymen were successful. They successfully abolished the cuts. Okay, and that was the end of the story, really, of 1919. Now, how far could these strikes have gone? It's hard to say, but Lloyd George, so the Prime Minister, when he spoke
to the leaders of the miners and the railway workers in the spring, he said, "In these circumstances, if you carry out your threat and strike, then you will defeat us. But if you do so, have you weighed the consequences? For if a force arises in the state which is stronger than the state itself, then it must be ready to take on the functions of the state." So basically, the Prime Minister was saying to the trade union leaders, you cannot lose. We know that you cannot lose. But if you have this strike, you will, the government will fall, the state will fall. You must be ready to lead a revolution. Yeah, that's what the Prime Minister was saying to the trade union leaders, and the trade union leaders were not at all ready for that, and that was one of the reasons why finally the trade union leaders did not want to go any further, because they didn't believe that another society that they could organise society in another way. So complicated. I mean, I'm summarising in 20 minutes, a very, 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 very complicated situation. But certainly, throughout, even more strongly than the 19th century, you see a difference between the trade union leaders and the ordinary members. And this will increase, because the government will begin to integrate trade union leaders into commissions and give them some sort of special role within the state, especially after the Second World War. And the second example that we have will be the general strike of 1926, and that's what I'm going to move on to now.